just because you know that you've got a diagnosis or something, you can't just stop your life, like, because you don't know what's around the corner and things like that.
Welcome back to The C Word, Kiwis Talk About Cancer. I'm your host, Helen King, and this is the podcast for cancer-y people. If you enjoy the show, please subscribe on Spotify or iTunes and come say hi on Facebook. While I'm on holiday, I've chosen two of my favourite episodes to replay so you don't miss out on your weekly dose of cancer-y conversations. Today's episode is My Tits Are Trying to Kill Me, and was one of the earlier episodes of the podcast. I first interviewed Lance Blackman last year when I thought the C Word was going to be a short series of videos with people talking about how breast cancer has impacted them. Lance is living with incurable breast cancer, yet I was struck by her incredible spirit and attitude about her situation. People with advanced cancer don't owe us to be inspirational or constantly upbeat about what's going on. But what I loved about Lance was her honesty. She talks about the whole roller coaster of her diagnosis and that she hasn't always dealt with it in a healthy way. And, you know, that's okay. We all have our own process. She was joined in the interview by her wife, Buffy Small. And Buffy has actually had her own experience with breast cancer and is now facing it again with Lance. The interview was during the first lockdown, and Lance had just had what was meant to be another surgery. But when the surgeon went in, they didn't quite find what they thought they would.
They didn't do anything.
No.
So they gave you all those drugs for nothing.
Well, it was quite interesting. So for a start, they told me I had to check into surgery the day before, which I thought was a bit weird because I've had a few surgeries in my life and never have I had to go the day before. But so Buffy brought me to hospital. We sat around for a while, as you do, because that's what hospital's all about.
Yeah.
Finally, the surgeon came in, and it was kind of comical looking back, because he walked in and he went, all right, guys, I'm a bit concerned. And we were like, why? Don't. You can't just say that to...
Not a good way to start, like, when you catch up with the patient before their surgery, like, I'm a bit concerned. Like, not a good starting point, like...
No. It's like, oops, during the surgery, there's just some things you don't want to hear.
Yeah, exactly. So both of us kind of did a quick, oh, heck, what's he concerned about?
What's happening next?
Like, yeah, what's going on now? And he said, oh, I've reviewed your latest CT scan and we can't actually see anything. So I'm a little bit nervous that we're going to open you up tomorrow and we're not going to be able to do anything. And I thought, that's not concerning. That's like kind of quite good news, really.
Yeah. Yeah. What does that actually mean? Like, what does it... Has the person, is that in particular, has that helped or?
So my oncologist thinks it's the Herceptin.
Wow, yeah.
So I don't know kind of which drug is doing what, but the combination of the two seem to be really effective at the moment, probably even more so than they would have guessed. I think to start with, they were just hoping to halt the growth, but...
Wow.
To have shrunk it down to nothing visible is pretty neat.
It's amazing. And it's interesting because we talked to a woman in one of our earlier episodes who was part of the sort of protest and advocating for Herceptin to be funded. And we played a little bit of audio from a news interview from, I think it must have been Close Up at the time, because, you know, Herceptin, as we know, is very expensive.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
One of the arguments was, well, you know, not many women get the HER2 positive, so it's a lot of money. And I think until you get into the situation where it's your life that they're talking about, where you go, actually, this, you know, it doesn't matter what it costs.
Yes. Yeah. Save me. Well, interestingly, when I first went in for the consult, I think Narvin did bring up pertuzumab, but he said, oh, this is a drug that costs a lot of money, like 80,000 plus.
Yeah.
And unless your metastatic doesn't seem to make as much of a difference. So he said, I'm telling you about it as an option, but not really encouraging you to pursue it because it'll be expensive and probably not overly effective.
Yeah.
Yeah, but then once they found out I was metastatic, he applied to Pharmac for an exemption and they gave it to me. So I feel quite
lucky. Wow. That's amazing. So talk me through the pro, like, where does your head go when you hear that? Because I know when we first, when I first spoke to you, we talked a lot about, when you get that news that actually it's advanced and now we're talking about, life extending treatment. Where does your head go when they say, well, can't see it?
It was really odd, actually. So when I woke up from surgery, when I actually remember waking up, I could overhear the recovery nurse talking to another nurse and saying, oh, they didn't actually do anything to my patient. Like, they opened her up, but there was nothing to be done. And I was having, a little bit of anxiety coming off the drugs, so I was really disappointed because I was thinking, oh, they've put me through, I'm feeling terrible, and they didn't even do anything. That sucks.
Yeah.
But, if you look at it objectively, that's best case, because really, and I remember thinking back to my grandma having ovarian cancer when I was younger, they opened her up and they could do nothing, but that was because the cancer was so overwhelmingly everywhere that it was a waste of time about it. So, I felt torn between why did you put me through this and yay, this is a good outcome.
I just can't even imagine it. It's such a roller coaster anyway, when you're preparing for surgery. They messed with you, man.
Yeah, so the surgeon, when we went for the consult, he used the term curative, which confused me because I, having been told previously incurable, I thought it doesn't make much sense. And on further discussions with the oncologist, he kind of said, curative for that particular set of lesions, but going on past experience with breast cancer, kind of don't get too excited for long term. Be excited absolutely right now, but can't go skipping down the road going, I'm cancer free, it's finished.
It's
likely at some point, potentially.
And I thought about the situation because I know when Lance and I first spoke, Buffy, that she mentioned that you'd had breast cancer as well, and because my brain isn't always very fast, I was sort of processing that thought of, you've already had your own experience and, a lot of us understand what that entails. But then to have your partner, your wife going through the exact same thing, that must be quite a, I want to say strange experience, because I don't know if that's the right word, but what's it been like for you?
I think strange is a good way to sum it up, because it is... you're in disbelief to start with, because when she got diagnosed, when she said, I found a lump, I was like, the chances of you having breast cancer as well, are fucking so slim. Oh, excuse me.
That's all right. We did, don't worry, honestly, we did an episode recently where I lost count of the times that we said vagina and no one complained. And if there was one thing that, would be complained about, it was, vagina repeatedly, so.
Yeah. it was a shock, and it was how crazy is the world for that to happen. But at the same time, was I've been on my own journey, so I can support her. And I thought that, for me, that was good. But for me in the early stages, because of her diagnosis, it actually brought up a whole lot of stuff for me that made me realize that I hadn't actually dealt with any of my stuff on my journey. I literally just buried my head in the sand and carried on nothing had happened. I didn't go to counsellors, I didn't do anything like that. I just just cracked on. And so when Lyme was diagnosed, for me, it was really hard initially because I felt like because I then was crumbling because I hadn't dealt with my stuff that I couldn't actually support her in a way that she needed to be supported. So it was a wake-up call for me that allowed me to get the go see a counsellor, actually do rehab, like, which I should have done the first time around, which I never did, and then kind of was reluctant to do it the second time around, and then finally got around to it like 18 months down the track. So I needed to put me in a good space to be able to support her properly, is what I felt. And so I felt like a failure to start with. But then as I kind of carried on my journey, I knew that I was able to help her on her journey. So, yeah.
Yeah, I was thinking as you were talking, it is really hard, I think, to recover from cancer. And I kind of feel like I've done it in little bits and bursts because you sort of, I don't know about you guys, but it's almost like you're so desperate for life to go back to normal, but you know that you don't feel normal, that everything's kind of changed, that it's almost like you can't really start processing that stuff until you're ready. And I don't, I sometimes have to hit a wall before I go, ooh.
Okay, yeah. I had a real big wall, obviously, with Lyme's diagnosis. That was like, well, actually, you have been burying your head in the sand for so long that it's probably not very healthy.
Yeah.
Really confronting, though. Yeah. Like, you don't have the choice when somebody else that you love is going through the same thing. You can't.
Yeah.
Well, you don't want to bury your head in the sand and pretend it's not happening to them.
Mm.
But that was okay, you thought, for you at the time. Yeah. So, yeah.
Probably. Yeah, absolutely. Because I know a little bit about your experience that that you were in your late 20s when you were diagnosed. Is that right?
So I was initially diagnosed in 2009. I was 27 years old. Initially diagnosed with DCIS. They did a lumpectomy, chopped out the lump. I thought, oh, yeah, end of story, crack on. I went to my follow-up appointment with my surgeon thinking that was the end of story, so I was there by myself. Mm-hmm. And he was like, so the margins were riddled with it as well, we want to do a mastectomy. And I was like, so to hear that by myself was, that's why you take a support person with you. Because even as a health professional, and he was a colleague of mine as well as my surgeon, like, it was really, really hard, and I kind of brave-faced it. Then it wasn't until I was driving home and called in to tell my mum I lost it. And then had my mastectomy reconstruction, did no physio, no rehab after that, just cracked on, re-enlisted in the army. And then in 2016, I deployed to Iraq. And prior to me deploying, I'd pulled a muscle under my arm and found a lump, and I thought it was to do with the fact that I pulled muscle, and then that got better and the lump stayed, and I was like, it's probably not good, but I don't want to be pulled off my trip to Iraq, so I'll just do nothing about it as a good health professional. And but I knew that because it hadn't gone away, and with my history, as soon as I got back from Iraq, I got it checked out, was diagnosed again. And basically what they think happened most likely is because I had a mastectomy already, was that there was just some random cells that got kind of trapped under the skin because it was quite superficial. That is like is associated from the last time. So cells that got trapped under the skin like turned nasty, and then just had a lumpectomy the second time, and then radiotherapy. I chose not to have chemo. They offered it to me, but I had a percentage figure in my head of like, it's going to improve my life expectancy by over this percentage, and I'll do it. If it's not over that percentage, then I'm not going to put myself through that kind of thing. And it was like way under the percentage figure that I had chosen. So I was like, nah, not interested in the chemo. I'll just have the radiotherapy, had that, and then, yeah.
Wow. So how many years ago was that?
So, yeah, 2016, so diagnosed at the start of 2017, and he had chemo middle of 2017. So, yeah, so 3 and a bit years, yeah.
Wow. So, I mean, I'm 2 years out from my diagnosis, and so I I kind of, as you're talking, I really get why Lance's diagnosis would have really, I mean, it'd be confronting anyway, but it's not that much time between your own experience and then it sort of being, you know.
Yeah, probably about 18 months between me finishing my treatment to her then getting diagnosed. So, yeah, not very long at all. And it was like, whoa.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's huge. Yeah, it's really, and it's funny because I knew a woman who was diagnosed the same time as I was, and strangely with the same type of HER2 positive. And I feel like she kind of just wanted to get on as well. And I think often we fall into different camps where some people are quite good at just sort of going, right, okay, that was it, I'll crack on. And I know for me, the way that I kind of dealt with it at the time was through social media. And so I sort of let people know what was going on in that way.
So it's quite, really like big difference between me and Lance because even my first diagnosis and then like the second diagnosis, like I told a few people and stuff like that. But it wasn't until like Lance's diagnosis and stuff that we had friends that had no idea that I'd ever been diagnosed at all, like because I just kept it really kind of to myself and to my bubble, where Lance like straight away kind of put it on Facebook and put it out there, and so real like blatantly two obviously different kind of journeys right from the start, with her being so public about her stuff. Like I could never write a blog because English was like, I feel like English is my second language.
You're better spoken than
me. Yeah. But then, and then for me it was like, just tell the people that needed to know. Like initially, like when I was diagnosed the first time, because my grandfather was dying at the same time and he was my favourite person in the whole entire world, like I didn't even tell my aunties and stuff because I was like, I don't want to put the stress of this on to them and the fact that their father's dying. Like, and so when they found out, when I had my first, like, I had my first surgery, I was going, like, getting ready for my second. And my auntie found out and she's like, why am I only finding out this now? And I was like, this is why. And she's like, okay, I understand your reasoning, but you should have told us. Like, but it was just the way I didn't want to put any more stress and like I wanted to deal with my issue, like my stuff, and I didn't want to burden anyone else.
Yeah. Do you know, I relate a lot to that because I didn't take anyone to my oncologist appointment, you know, the first one that you have where they go through everything. And so I spent 3 hours with them where we went through everything because it was kind of that same thing where I think part of me wanted that information first so I could kind of go, okay, that's what we're dealing with. But I think I'm similar and I have that tendency to think, oh, I want to protect people from this.
Yeah. And that was very much like, not that I'm saying that, like, because you put, like, because Lance put it on social media that she was wanting to not protect other people, but it was just obviously her way of dealing with it and my way of dealing with it. So that was kind of the real initial kind of thing that I found really interesting in our journey, like, was that the two different streams of that. And I took me a bit to kind of come to terms with, well, why are you putting it out there? Why, like, everyone's going to ask you every 5 minutes what's going on? Like, and yeah, so I took me a bit to kind of understand why she was doing it and stuff like that.
Mm. Yeah. What's that? Talk me through that a bit, Lance, because I sort of see both sides in a way. And I think I did the same where I just sort of kept people up to date on social media because it felt like a way that I could kind of express what was going on. Was it similar for you?
I diagnosed and then did I wait like 3 or 4 weeks for surgery? So I didn't have to wait too long. They were like, we want to do surgery reasonably quickly. And so I had spoken to my family and friends of mine that I'm close to. And when I went into hospital, I had no intentions of keeping people up to date. But for some reason, I just thought, I'll say something about the fact that I've had surgery. I'll tell them I've got cancer. And I think I wrote in the actual post at the time, I'm not going to be doing updates, but this is happening just so that people kind of know. And the responses I got
were just so varying. People were really supportive, really like passing on their love and all that sort of thing. And then it kind of made me realize that social media has put us on the periphery of a lot of people's lives. So you might have 10 friends that you actually text and meet up with, but then you might have another 30 friends who are closely following you on social media, but they live too far away and the time difference means you can't chat to them on the phone, but they care about everything that you post and they're like, oh, there's a picture of your dog, I love it. There's, you're on a family holiday, I love your family. Like, and they're really happy to kind of catch up with you. Then there are the people the next step back who you might have gone to school with or might have been close with when you were younger but are not anymore. And that layer of people are still interested but would never call you because you haven't spoken to them in 15 years. It would be weird. So, yeah, it kind of turned into keeping people updated, worked through all those levels, but at the same time, where Buffy's quite private and really stoic, I cry at the drop of a hat and like to tell people everything. Yeah. So it turned into almost like a dear diary sort of thing, especially starting the blog. And then, yeah.
I remember one thing that you did say when you didn't first make it social, like,
I put out there, about yours.
Is that you, like, she didn't say anything about me. Like with my journey and stuff, and I did ask you why, and I found that kind of weird. But she was like, "Well, because that's not what you wanted, so I haven't been throwing you out there into the world." And so that was fine. We dealt with that. But I remember a key thing that you did say when you first started putting stuff out there is that you wanted to be able to make a difference. Like I had almost made a difference for you because of my history, made her hyper aware of obviously self checks and stuff like that. And so Lan said, if I can put it out there and make people aware that you don't have to be like in your 40s, 50s to get breast cancer, like when you get actually tested with mammograms and stuff, that if she can make a difference in one person's life, then that's worth putting it out there on social media as well. So that was a big driving force behind her doing what she did.
Yeah.
Yeah, I totally relate to that. Because it's funny because I think even we have quite similar stories of how we found a lump, that it was just like total accident. Oh, it won't be anything. And then, you know, the rest is history. And I've often felt that although, you know, we are in the minority being younger people being diagnosed with cancer, but I think that you still need to be aware that it can happen and that you should never, ever feel that you are, you know, overreacting or wasting a doctor's time to get something checked out. Because I know for me, it being, you know, it was quite aggressive. And even at stage two, I had 3 large tumours that had got into my lymph nodes. So by being a hypochondriac, getting it checked out, you know, it saved
your own life, really.
Yeah. All got that treatment a lot faster.
Well, I don't know if you saw, and there was an article and stuff maybe a month ago about the woman that really hit me because we were the exact same age. She was 36. She was a health coach and a PT.
Yes.
And a nutritionist and a
healthy freak. Ticked all the proper boxes for you. Yeah. You shouldn't have cancer because you're quite good at life.
Yeah.
And, you know, she went to the doctor and they were like, you don't really have any risk factors and you've got all these plus things in the other column, and coupling that with a referral for a scan going AWOL, and then it turned out by the time she was diagnosed it was far too late.
Yeah.
So, I don't know, people could say you're a hypochondriac, but at the same time you could be like, well, actually I'm a hero because I saved myself from everything. It'd be awful if you'd waited 6 months or a year.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting, isn't it? Because, I mean, you guys are both really fit and healthy. I mean, Lance, you do all sorts of crazy running, swimming.
A crazy thing she does, yeah.
It's explained so much better.
Once, eh?
I know, but you do have to explain it because I couldn't believe, I could just... I'm in awe of people that can do anything physical either during chemo or after. I mean, I've seen it described as looking like a prednisone sausage, and that was what I, that was me. I just turned into this bald sausage.
I must say it was interesting for me. So my whole life I've been a skinny runt, really. I was a little skinny kid, stayed a little skinny adult until my early 30s when I drank too much beer and I became a weirdly chubby in one spot skinny adult with like a tiny spare tire around my top of my jeans. But, you know, probably still hovering around maybe 55 kgs because I'm pretty short too. And, yeah, not long after starting, I think I gained 10 kgs pretty quick starting chemo. And I remember enlisting my flatmate who used to look after me some days after chemo. I said, bro, we've got to go to the shop. And she goes, why do you want to go to the mall? And I said, I'm too fat for my jeans. Like, they're uncomfortable to sit down because they're, like, digging in. And, like, I spend heaps of my day sitting, so
yeah.
I want comfy pants. And she was like, sweet bro, we'll go buy some fat chemo jeans.
Yes.
It was really funny. And then I read heaps about it in the support groups and stuff, and some people said they gained 15 kgs, some people gained 20, and I was like, all right, so how did we get screwed with the only type of chemo that makes you gain weight? Like, yeah, everyone else, they're like, oh, no, you're losing weight. And I'm like, oh, that could be a bonus. Maybe my little muffin top will disappear. And they're like, nah, you're going to get fat. Sorry.
Yeah. I remember seeing someone and I was bald as a baby and just bloated. And they said, oh, I thought that the patients are meant to be skinny. And there I am like.
You're like, thanks, bro. I don't already feel shit.
Yeah. Thanks.
Yeah. But a lot of that's why I wanted to blog, because people have these preconceived ideas of what someone with breast cancer would be going through.
Yes.
Whereas I'm sure Buffy could recount better than me the day she went to work and I ate six people's worth of food. I was starving. I thought I was dying.
Okay, but she texted me during the day and she's like, this chemo is like going to like, it's making me feel like I'm starving to death. I just can't stop eating and stuff. And I got home from work and I was like, how much have you eaten?
I've written everything down.
And I was like, literally, this is like six people's worth of food. And I was like,
you can't be hungry.
I was like, you can't be hungry. She's like, no, I'm starving. Like, I feel like I need to eat. And then we took the dogs for a walk. We walked down the dog park and I just asked her more questions. And like, honestly, my nurse's hat on and like asking more questions. And I was like, this doesn't sound like you're like, this is the chemo, like making you eat constantly. It sounds like you've got reflux, like, because you eat and you feel better when you're eating and you stop eating and then you get the reflux.
You like, feel sick again.
Feel sickness and then so you start eating again and that cures it. And I was like, so when we get home, just going to try this little experiment and we're going to give you some Gaviscon to see what happens. Surprisingly enough, the Gaviscon worked. And turns out she had acid reflux and was not going to like turn into a balloon because the chemo was making her like starve.
Lucky though, because honestly, that was only one day of eating six people's worth of food. If you didn't know to ask me that, I might have done 5 months of eating six people's
worth
of
food. And oh my God.
She would have been a full blimp.
Well, that would have been outstanding. But, you know, these are the sorts of things that I wanted to write about, and I tried to be kind of really honest but comical at the same time because,
yeah,
I don't know. I felt like people don't want to be depressed reading my story, but you still don't want to lie.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I tried to kind of bridge that gap between being funny and being honest so people can go, oh, shit, that's weird. I didn't know that was a possible side effect.
Yeah, it's true, though, isn't it? Because I kind of feel like I had to laugh at it sometimes because it was just some days it was just like, this is horrific. When you realise that every inch of your body has been affected by chemo. I remember looking in the mirror one day and going, oh, my eyelashes have gone.
Yeah.
When did that happen?
That's quite annoying.
Yeah.
It's like two rogue eyelashes that like just held out when you were like all deaf and they're like one on each eye that just refused to like leave. It was so funny.
I had to wear sunglasses in the rain. Because I just said no.
Yeah.
Walking the dogs and it would be windy and I'd just be walking around like,
I can't see.
I've got to close my eyes as much as possible.
to actually stop the crap from getting in there.
There was one hard part for me on this journey is the fact that because I chose not to have chemo, like all the like surgery, radiotherapy, all of that, I could support her heart out because I'd been there and I knew exactly like kind of what to expect and that sort of stuff. But as soon as she hit the chemo part of her journey, I felt relatively useless because I hadn't, because it was uncharted waters for me as well, and so I didn't, so it was a learning, like it was a learning curve for me taking my nursing knowledge and putting it like and having to kind of more deal with her as a like as a almost like a patient as opposed to oh yeah, this is how I felt when I went through it and this is like this is normal and stuff like that. That was completely foreign to me, and so that was a real challenge, and I found that really hard once we hit that point, like because yeah, I just couldn't, I felt like I'd supported as well, like, because I'd been through different, like, the other parts of it, but that part I was just like, it's foreign to me, I have no idea.
And that must be really challenging as well because, you know, as you've mentioned, you're a nurse, you've trained and you work in a profession that, you know, that cares and you know, have that knowledge, but then at the same time, this is your wife. So it's that. I can imagine it must be, it must have been really hard at times to kind of navigate that.
I think, yeah, it definitely was. And it's different when you work in like the hospital setting and stuff because you can tell your patient to do something and they generally do it. You're telling them to do it. When it's your wife, you tell them to do something because like you know and understand from a medical point of view why they need to do this and they go, I'm not going to do it. And then it takes them to talk to someone else that says the same thing for them to do it, and you're like, well, if you'd done it when I said, then this would have been dealt with ages ago. But okay, clearly, I'm not. My advice is not good enough.
You're a bad patient, aren't you?
Definitely a little bit.
A terrible, whingy, fucking patient.
I actually found, and I'm not sure if we've spoken about this. I feel like we have, but maybe after a few beers, I'm not sure if you remember, but. Like, yes, Buffy's medical knowledge going through chemo was invaluable. So the night I woke up with really terrible acid reflux to the
point. Can I just put a, like, a caveat here? I'm an intensive care nurse. I'm not an oncology nurse. So, yeah.
Yeah, so, like, the night that I woke up and I felt like I couldn't breathe. Like, it felt like there was a wet washcloth over my lungs. And I was like, Jesus, am I dying? Like, this seems serious. So I sat up in bed, Buffy woke up. I was, you know, reasonably frightened. And I think if I'd been on my own.
You were quite distressed, yeah.
I probably would have trundled myself down to the hospital to make sure if I was dying, I'd be at least in a good place, not in bed. But, you know, Buffy had like a really kind of calming influence, being a medical professional and knowing what to look for in certain situations. Can be calming for the patient because you're like, all right, well, if the nurse isn't panicking, I'm clearly not fine. So,
yeah. But
putting Buffy's medical experience aside, probably the most valuable thing that I think she brought to the table while I was doing chemotherapy was she has like a really good instinct to know when there's something wrong with me and was quite good at eventually getting me to be able to verbalize it, because I don't know about you, but I've had other mental health issues before cancer. I've dealt with anxiety, and the hard part is when people go, what's wrong? And you're like, I don't know. And either you think nothing's wrong or you're like, everything's wrong and I don't even know what to talk about. But
yeah,
is especially skilled at kind of extracting that information. She helped me to be able to help everyone else understand how I was feeling, which I think probably made our lives a lot easier because, as you can tell, I'm a pretty chatty person. So, you know, if I'm just sitting there silently, the household seems weird because it's much too quiet.
Yeah.
That, I think, to me, made the biggest difference.
Yeah.
He helped me get my feelings out.
And it was just about finding, I suppose that kind of falls back to my intensive care nursing, like our patients are intubated or have a trachea and they can't talk. So you find other ways and means of communication with them. And so I just discovered with Lance that if she was upset and I said, what's wrong? She would generally just break down in tears and couldn't understand anything anyway. But she couldn't vocalize how she was feeling, so I gave her the option of, like, write me a letter.
Mm. Oh, wow.
And so she would write me, so when she was upset and stuff, she would write me a letter, and that was her way, because she's such a good writer and stuff, like, it's easy for her to put words onto a piece of paper that meant she could write everything down on a piece of paper, give it to me, I could read it, and then I could come back to her and go, okay, let's talk about this. And then, like, it was that good. It's almost like that icebreaker of, like, I'm upset, don't know how to talk about it, don't know how to express it, but I'm going to tell you in this other form, and then I can bring it, and then we can bring it back, and we can then go from there. And that was really, really beneficial, because for ages, like, she'd just be upset, and there'd be something wrong, and I could tell there was something wrong, and she couldn't communicate, like, verbally, because she struggled. And so, but once I gave her that other means, that just opened a whole world for her, which then obviously led in, like, I don't think that partly led into the blogs as well and stuff like that. And just, yeah,
definitely. And that's the biggest tip that I've given anybody who's reached out to me and said, oh, I'm going through cancer, or somebody I know is going through cancer, how can I be helpful, is staying in touch and communicating. Because I think you tell people you have cancer, I could show you the post that I wrote when I was in hospital and 60 messages that said, if you need anything, reach out.
What does that mean?
But you don't. Like, you think that's really nice. But
yeah,
my opinion is, if you want to help somebody who's going through cancer treatment or their family, you need to offer a specific thing, like,
absolutely.
Do you like this? Does this day work?
It's so true that, to me, yeah, that whole, can I say, if there's anything I can do to help, is just the most meaningless thing, because it's the people. I had this woman that I met years ago and kind of stayed in contact with over Facebook. And her husband has an incurable cancer, and so they've been dealing with this for a long time. And she would turn up every Tuesday night with dinner. And if she couldn't turn up, it was sent some other way. And that was what I needed. Like, you just needed that practical stuff, because I don't know about you guys, but I found it really hard interacting with people, because when people said, how are you? I couldn't really say how I was, because you know that they don't want to No. I mean, they don't. It's like, how am I? Well, I'm shit scared I'm going to die, and I wake up in a panic every morning.
And
I have no eyelashes. All my hair's falling out.
Yeah. I'm putting on weight. We're on from here.
I'm eating great. How are you?
But I think sometimes that can be helpful. And I actually had one or two friends, our flatmate Haley included, who, when she said, how are you, she actually wanted those details.
Yeah.
Like, are you angry today? Do you feel sick today? Do you feel pissed off? Do you feel happy? Do you want to go for a walk? Like, I think some people are truly interested. And if you are, you should say something like, how are you, honestly?
Yeah.
Feel permitted to go, actually, I'm having a shocker. And then you can tell them all about it, because, you know, they want to know.
Because otherwise, generally, it's just lip service. People say that because that's what society has taught us to say as part of a greeting, oh, how are you? And then the normal reaction is, oh, I'm good, or oh, okay, and that's end of story. Yeah. Like, no one gives a fuck about that side of it. Like,
they don't.
I think because of concrete offers of help are probably the best. So, for example, this didn't apply to me, but I know it applies to a lot of women, is childcare.
Of course,
I will watch your children while you're at treatment, or I will watch your children for a few days after treatment, after work, because I know we just want to lie down.
Or I will come and clean your house, or...
Yes, most moms do the shopping so you don't have to leave the house.
Yeah, and I know that, I've read it before, and I know that my my partner Ross felt this too, where often the partners are kind of forgotten, where you guys are going through it too. And I mean, we I don't know, we sort of muddled through it. And then sort of similar to, I guess, what you've talked about, Buffy, where I think we hit a wall as a couple a few, like, months after it, because it's that sort of thing. We've both gone through this hugely traumatic thing, me as a, you know, as the individual with it, and him as the loved one watching, and just trying to sort of wade yourself through all those emotions and things. What has been helpful for you as the partner? Has it, as you talked before about seeking your own help?
Yeah, so I think that's key is, yeah, like, reach, like, it's not just about the person that's going through it at the time. As a partner, you are, like, it's okay to have bad days. It's okay to feel like you hate the person because everything is just so focused on you and all your attention, and all you just want is a break, and that's okay, and it's, you're allowed to do that. But it's just realizing that, yeah, there is help out there for you, and you can, like, get out there and get it and stuff like that. But it's interesting, like, what you said was, like friends would ask, like, predominantly, like, oh, how's Lance doing? How's Lance doing? And so it's all about Lance. Everything's about Lance. But every now and then you'll get that friend that would be like, how's Lance doing? Tell him about how Lance doing. And then they'll be like, and how are you? And you'll go, oh, I'm good. And they'll be like, no, actually, how are you doing? Like, and that, it was the difference, because it, like, it's natural. Society is, at the moment is designed around the way that you hear the cancer word and, like, everyone loses their, like, has no idea how to cope. And so the focus comes on the person that's going through it. But, yeah, they forget about that support network beside them. And when, yeah, but when you get those friends and family that go, no, actually, or they just send you a text and just like, actually, how are you? And they don't ask anything about, like,
the patient.
And
yeah.
And those were the things, like, those were the moments where I got messages like that weren't necessarily from my friends, but were from, like, Lanza's friends and her network that were contacting me and just been like, how are you actually doing? Like, and that was really important. But it's key for the support person or support people to be recognised, because it's a massive journey.
Yeah, absolutely. And I wanted to touch on something else, and it was, I think when I first interviewed you, Lance, I was really aware that people skirt around the terminal issue or the terminal diagnosis.
So it was interesting, the day that I was told I had metastatic cancer, Buffy was actually really sick. So we decided that she shouldn't come to the appointment, because obviously, medical oncology is full of fragile people that don't need to be around somebody who's got a cold flu or a cold or whatnot. And as soon as my oncologist came to get me, he said, oh, where's Buffy? And I went, oh, I've left her at home. She's really sick. And he goes, you can call her. She can come in. And I was like, she probably shouldn't. She's, like, quite sick. But we'll phone her and we'll get her in. And immediately I was like, oh, this is obviously great, because usually tell you to bring your sick support person in if you're going to get good news.
Yeah.
And that was all right, like, Scott Buffy in, so she was part of the whole conversation. And when I got home, because I was a little bit too stunned to ask any useful questions, I think I just said what I thought were, like, some witty statements, and then was like, I don't really know what to do. So I got home and I had a cry, and one of the first things we talked about was the difference between terminal and incurable, because, you know, you do the Googling and breast cancer, they say 56 months is the average for a metastatic person, and I was like, that's not very long. I'm feeling a bit emotional about that. And then Buffy brought up a lot of really good points, like they've caught it much earlier than they do in a lot of people, and, like, I've been stupidly lucky for a few reasons. But yeah, I was like, so am I terminal now? Am I dying? And Buffy went, no, there's a difference between terminal and incurable.
Wow.
that made a real big difference, because I think Terminal just has those, you think back to the movies again, or your granddad or your auntie or anybody that you know, and you're like, oh great, I'm dying like tomorrow.
Yeah.
And it's so weird, was weird for me personally to still not feel ill. I was like, I feel fine. Like, how how can I be sick and dying if I feel fine?
It's just, it's true, isn't it? Because I guess it's the same, at the beginning where you don't feel sick with cancer, but then you have this horrific chemo, that's what makes you sick.
Honestly, though, like, if I think, and obviously our journeys were very different, but if I encapsulate being a patient and encapsulate being a support person, I found it much harder to support Buffy than to go through it myself.
Yeah.
And I think... I agree. I definitely the same, like, yeah.
Because I think, like you brought up just before, a really good point, is when you're the patient, everything's about you. Everything's about you. Everybody's asking about you. All appointments are centered around you. Everything is you focused. So at least during treatment, you feel attended to.
Yes.
Like, all right, everybody cares about how I'm doing, my bloods, my diet, my everything. Yeah. And I think a lot of the questions for the support person can be kind of cursory. Like, they're like, oh, how are you doing? But actually, we're kind of here to talk about the patient.
Yeah.
Whereas, the patient, for me, especially not being a health professional, probably made that a little bit different, was I just felt so helpless watching Buffy have surgery and radiotherapy, and I really wanted to be helpful, but I didn't know how. And I wanted to talk to her about she was feeling, but I didn't want to make her live through it if she didn't want to.
Yeah.
There were just so many things I felt not confident and frightened about that as a patient. I didn't feel those things in that way because I was like, all right, you're talking to me about numbers, fine. You're talking to me about this, fine. You're making me understand things, great, I get it. Mm. But as a support person, I was just scared.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And I guess because I think we discussed this when we first chatted, and like, I could imagine telling someone you have cancer kind of stops the conversation anyway. It's a conversation stopper. But I imagine when you're dealing with, you're dealing with having advanced cancer, that's even more difficult, that people don't want to talk about it. How do you even face that as a couple or within a family, you know?
I think, Angela, if I could start this. Well, when we came home, I was pretty upset, and I said, what do we do? Do we even think about buying a house? Do we plan future vacations? Should I, what should I do? And Buffy was like, well, if you think about it, no one knows when you're going to die. You just may have a little bit more of an idea of what's going to kill you, but you still don't know when. Like, you could get all freaked out about having cancer and die in a car crash in a week. There's nothing to do with having cancer, like, hopefully not, obviously.
Yeah.
Or the COVID could get you, or, like, there's just so many things, and it can put a real stress on you, but we chose not to let it because we were like, well, do you know what? It could be 18 months or 18 years, and that pretty much puts me in the same boat as most people.
If anyone, exactly.
Stuff it. We'll just carry on as normal until cancer makes us change direction.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I think a little bit of the insight in why I talked about that like that is having been like being an intensive care nurse, and I see the worst of people when they're coming and they're dying or they're about to die and stuff like that, like through whether it's horrific trauma or disease process or whatnot, and you can't just live like just because you know that you've got a diagnosis of something, you can't just stop your life like because you don't know what's around the corner and things like that. Like I had a patient, and this like one patient in particular just makes me like take that, like, look at that in real, like, so she got, so our New Zealand Army has these things called labs that they're like our big kind of tank-looking things.
Mm.
And she was driving in her car one day, and it was just after we got labs, and something went wrong with the lab, and it crushed her and her car between the lab and a tree. And she survived that. Like, and that kind of was like, wow, you just survived a miracle of, like, the fact that you just literally, like, crushed between, like, a giant tank and a tree in your tiny little car. And she survived that, and it was all good. And, I wasn't involved, like, with her in that stage. Then I nursed her, like, 10 years later in intensive care, and the simplest infection nearly, killed her. And it was like, you just don't know, like, what the world has for you out there. And so you've got to live every day you've got to live, basically. Like, you can't just go, okay, you've been now diagnosed as you've got incurable cancer. We can't just stop living, because we don't, if we stop living, that stopping living could be for the next 10, 15 years, or it could be, for the next 5 months kind of thing. You just don't know, but you've got to make the most of what everyone, it doesn't matter if you've got incurable cancer or not, everyone just has to, and that's what my journey opened me up to, is don't sweat the small things, live life to the max kind of thing,
Yes. Yeah, I was going to say, actually, I was going to ask that before, whether you guys had that. For me, I kind of, I feel like I have a smaller tolerance for bullshit. So it's just...
I don't think you had a great one to start with.
That's probably true as well, but now I have at least a tolerance for bullshit.
Yeah.
I find I am more tolerant and forgiving in general.
Yeah.
I just think, you know what, it actually doesn't matter. Do I need to come to that? No, I don't.
Yeah. It's funny because I was thinking, as you were talking before, and I sort of, my head went back to, I had a really hard time, I guess, the sort of, actually, I think that first year after all the when I was still having the Herceptin, that I started to notice that I couldn't make plans, because I think I still had that whole thing hanging over me of, as a friend is... said to me, you faced your mortality, and that's what I mean, when you, I guess if you have a brush with death like your colleague had, it's just been, life has just gone surprise, you're not in charge here. But I've gradually got to the point where it's exactly what you're talking about, is I don't know when I'll go. You're right. I could go outside and trip over and have a freak accident.
Yeah.
So just sort of putting those things in place and doing things that I'd always wanted to do but had put off, because you kind of have that shake-up of actually life is quite short and really crap things can happen. So just keep living as if, things are fine. And
oh, absolutely.
Thanks for joining me today. I'll be back with a new episode on January 17th, and you can check out all past episodes on planetaudio.org.nz/thecword or on Spotify and all major podcast platforms. Thank you so much for your support in 2020. It has been a truly bizarre year, but I have utterly loved creating this podcast, and all the support and amazing messages, and just being able to connect with other people that have had the same experience with cancer. So thank you so much, and I can't wait to bring you more episodes in the new year and keep having these cancery chats. The C Word, Kiwis Talk About Cancer, is on Planet FM every Sunday at 11:55 a.m. on 104.6 FM in Auckland, or anytime at planetaudio.org.nz/thecword. See you next time.